The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism. So last night I spoke about the beginning of point six, which Norman Fisher calls the discipline of relationship, and Trungpa Rinpoche calls the discipline of mind training. So discipline is the key word here. And there are a number of slogans in this point six, all of them having to do with how we bring our practice to the world. And as I spoke about last night, I had a wonderful opportunity to bring my practice to the world through spending the afternoon at urgent care. And I have to say I'm very happy to be back and sick, but not dying. Well, I don't know that. I guess we're all dying. At least not maybe right now. Well, we'll see. That would be maybe one of the most interesting Dharma talks. It would go down in history. And that attitude is one of the things that this particular slogan, the first slogan, warns us about. Don't try to go down in history could be one part of it. Because, you know, the human mind is very complex, as I spoke about last night. Human relationships are very complex. And one of the pointers in this slogan from Trungpa is the way that the Dharma itself can be a dangerous enterprise. It can, if we don't remember that we are all one body, that we are all one community of breathing and sharing viruses and all kinds of other stuff, sharing care and comfort, sharing distress and I'm trying to think of a polite English word, mix-ups. this is something then that hardens us if we forget this, and it makes us go into a kind of divisiveness where we think that we're the most important person on the planet, not those other people. And of course, this is something that the Lojong teachings keep emphasizing. Don't put yourself first. Don't think that you're the only one. Remember what's important. Remember that we are all together. And it was kind of a beautiful thing. Our sutra service this morning, I can't recall a time, it felt like we were just one mind, not quite understanding how to play the instruments or even chant. It was terrific. Nobody was exempt. And some of us have these colds that are impairing our ability to chant, and so we couldn't keep the chants up, and we were coughing, and the bells were coming at all these interesting places, and the drums, and the mukugyo, and the little bell. And so what, right? Because I think that experience, for me anyway, was another example of our shared humanity. And because it was contagious, it was even more delightful. If it had just been one of us, then we could go into shame and, oh my God, I'm the worst person in the world. But it was sort of like once one mistake happened, everybody started making mistakes. Oh God, and I can't laugh. Okay, I'll calm down for a moment. which reminds me of a wonderful story about Layman Pang, the Tang Dynasty master who was not ordained, which is why he was called layman, and who traveled with his wife and two children selling baskets after giving up a fairly upper class life in the cities. And he got turned onto Zen and turned them all onto Zen, his wife and his children. And one day he and his daughter were out selling baskets, and he tripped and fell and landed in the mud and started saying, "Help, help." And his daughter threw her baskets down, started running for for her father, and threw herself in the mud. And her father said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "Oh, I'm helping you, Father. All of us in the mud together. All of us finding a way to recognize our common humanity. So in this particular slogan, Come Back to Basics, the commentators are telling us what the basics are. And they are, of course, remembrance of this human life, which is brief and fleeting and full of sickness, old age, and death, and separation from those we love. That's just the way it is. And that also the great luck of being born human so that we can awaken to the Dharma, and the brevity of this practice. But the dangerousness of the Dharma is that we might think that when we have these awakenings, when we have a glimpse or a really profound experience of the non-dual and the dual coming together so there are no more opposites, when that happens for us, we can get kind of full of ourselves, because it's easy for the mind to retreat into its normal division of you and me, us and them. Very dangerous. One of the things that the Buddha said is one of the worst sins that human beings can do who are Buddhists, who are part of a Buddhist Sangha, is to create division in the Sangha. This is the worst thing, because it's just emphasizing the natural human tendency to create division, to start having arguments and fights and wars and culminating in killings and nuclear bombs and all kinds of terrorist attacks and things like that. This misunderstanding, this leads to division ultimately, and it's one of the worst things one can do. And yet, it happens. You know, sometimes we say when people are getting divorced that it's the best thing to do, because the two narratives of the spouses are no longer in sync with each other, and it causes less harm to go separate ways, less harm for the children, less harm for the parents, less harm for the world probably. So recognizing that division is occurring is so important. Widening it with recrimination, not so good. And you can feel how delicate this matter is. It's not so simple. It's not so clear, really. It's something to practice. So I talked last night about the first part of Come Back to Basics, which is always abide by the three principles, and the first principle is mindfulness, or paying attention and keeping the vows of the three refuges and the bodhisattva vows. So going on to the second of these three principles, three basic principles, Fisher says, renew and keep to your commitment. That was for the first one. He says for the second one, don't act outrageously. What? Don't act outrageously. And of course, he's basing this on what happens to people when they get full of the Dharma, full of, oh, this is great. Now I'm going to go around and tell everybody how great it is, and instruct my parents and my children and my friends in the Dharma, and they should come to Boundless Way Temple because it's the greatest thing. It's just, oh, it's such a wonderful place. And you know, the light comes in the window, or we leave a retreat and we try to tell people what we experienced. I saw the light on the floor. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a little bit of the acting outrageously. Trungpa says the same thing, refrain from outrageous action. And he also says that this is a pair with acting benevolently. So it's a connection to the first one of remembering to keep the refuges and the bodhisattva vows. To remember, essentially, that we're all in this together. And that the best way to teach people about Buddhism is to practice it privately, that is, be with people and remember the vows, and not tell people that you're keeping the vows. I'm a bodhisattva. You know, none of the people in urgent care said, I'm a bodhisattva. Even Ray and I didn't say that. It would have been outrageous behavior it would have been, look at me, I'm so wonderful. Somewhere in, I think it's in Trungpa, he talks about, you know, you could do things like lie down in the street to show your, lie down in traffic to show your wonderful Dharma genius, or you could go on a fast to end suffering, or you could get yourself crucified. I don't know who he was talking about. But he puts that in the category of outrageous behavior, because it is this look at me kind of thing. Not done from the attitude of benevolence, of seeing. And he calls this Mahayana benevolence, the great vehicle benevolence. This is that same thing when Lemon Pong's daughter helps by falling into the mud with her father. When all of us helped each other with the sutra service this morning by continuing to misunderstand what we were supposed to do, who knows? Maybe there is this wonderful quality that human beings who are recognize that they're on the great vehicle, that is on the big boat, the big ferry that carries everyone from the world of form to the other shore, where we recognize the truth of awakening and the truth of the integration of form and emptiness. Emptiness is no other than form, and form is no other than emptiness. We hear those words and we go, huh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then some moment happens and we say, oh, oh, just this moment is everything. And then we become divided again because we think, I just had an insight. And then that's the invitation to act outrageously. So then the third part is what Norman Fisher calls don't be one-sided. And Trungpa calls it developing patience, developing crazy wisdom. These three things don't seem to be the same. How does crazy wisdom and patience and not being one-sided all fit? So starting with Norman Fisher's wonderful Zen interpretation of all this, don't be one-sided is just what I've been pointing to. Don't divide yourself. Don't divide yourself against others. Don't divide yourself against yourself. In the internal puppet show, there's nobody but us. There's just the different voices of the self taking roles and talking to each other, thinking that we're having arguments with real people in the world, and we're not. They're probably off watching television or having tea or driving somewhere, and we're arguing with them as if they're right in front of us. It's an amazing human capacity to create the way, to create ghosts in the mind, and to carry on fantasy conversations. We can do this endlessly, and one of the places that we do it a lot is during our Zazen. If you've noticed, Alan was talking the other day about the different things that the mind does in neurological research. You know, as he said, not the most robust research, but suggestive and very much in alignment with what we know from our Buddhist practice, that the mind tends to do three things. It tends to ruminate about the past. It tends to plan the future. And then the middle one, being in the present moment, have all these arguments and judgments and aversion and attraction, all of this stuff happening right now. I wish it was warmer. I wish it was cooler. I wish I wasn't sick. I wish they weren't sick. I wish that that the food was different. I wish, I wish, I wish. This is, how much do we preoccupy ourselves with these three basic activities of the mind? And anybody who sat for longer than a couple of minutes knows this very well. The great thing in Zen, from my point of view, is that this is not a problem. Just like the cluster event that happened earlier with our sutra service is not a problem. This is what human beings do. This is how we are. As we say, one mistake after another, a continuous mistake. That's actually adapted from a line by Dogen, where he says, if you try to do something, it's a mistake. If you don't do something, it's a mistake. If you neither, you know how it goes, if you neither do something or don't do something, etc. So mistakes, because human beings don't have omniscience. We don't know everything. Awakening to the Dharma can sneakily suggest to us that we suddenly do have omniscience, that we are, in fact, in charge of everything, in charge of the world, in charge of the way things are supposed to be, and then when they don't go our way, we think we have to practice more to get more control. And it's just the opposite. As we've been hearing about the weather, we don't control the weather. I love yesterday in urgent care, everybody was talking about the big snowstorm that's coming, and I kept checking my weather app, and of course the sky was blue. It said on my weather app that it was cloudy and that snow was due any moment. Oh gosh. So the 3 feet of snow that are predicted for the weekend were nowhere to be seen in my weather app. Maybe it's been updated today, but I don't know. I haven't checked it. If it snows, we will deal with that. If it doesn't snow, we will deal with that. If I get sick, we will deal with that. If I don't get sick, we will deal with that. There's no control, and there is no control not only about making mistakes or doing things right, but also about what happens in our minds. We are continuously full of thoughts. And these thoughts are producing themselves because the brain is an organ of thinking, just like the eye is an organ of seeing and the ears are an organ of hearing, receiving what is visual, receiving what is auditory, receiving thoughts. The mind in Buddhism is considered the sixth sense. And we take all of these six senses and bring them together and make conclusions. Our consciousness, the seventh consciousness, as David was talking about the other day, nuisance consciousness, strings together all of our perceptions, and creates narratives that are very strong. And no one can talk us out of them until we discover for ourselves that all narratives are incorrect on the deepest level. This moment contains everything, so there is all the thinking that's going on, the memories and the plans and the present moment judgments, all of that going on, and all the other senses, all the other five senses, the body and everything else, and the stories, the seventh consciousness, the stories. The eighth consciousness, Alaya, is the one where we get free of the other seven, where we see through, where we understand that they are all temporary arisings, moment after moment after moment. We don't even see through them with any kind of narrative, because narratives have been dropped away. As Dogen says in the text we read today, to study the way is to study the self, and to study the self is to forget the self. Things drop away. We don't drop them away. They leave when they're ready. I was talking with one of you, actually a couple of you over the last couple of days about the misunderstanding about the phrase letting go in modern self-help movements, letting go. I like to say letting come and go, emphasis on the letting. Things come and go. Snowstorms come, the 6 feet of snow burying the temple, 10 feet of snow, or the sun shines through the windows. Are we in charge of this? I don't think so. It's never been my experience. Although, man, so many times in my life, I have actively prayed that there is either a snowstorm, this was when I was a child, I got a snow day, or please, when I was a school teacher, please let there be no snow so that I don't have to figure out whether to cancel my class or not. On we go, praying, wanting to be in control. How delightful, really. And in this, now you might be able to see where these three lines come together. Don't be one-sided, developing patience, and crazy wisdom. So not being one-sided means that we don't favor the things we like over the things we dislike. In the realm of relationships, we don't favor people we like over people we don't like. We just treat everyone as a part of the great community of being, the human community, or also animals, plants, all beings, as we say. Everything, all interacting with each other, absolutely not separate. So not making that division. And having patience is part of it, because we would like things to be a certain way. So I would like my cold to be gone by the time my grandson is born. I really want that. When I was afraid that my illness, when the doctor said, you know, we're going to check you, you may have had a silent heart attack, I was really, really anguished that I would miss my grandson's birth. It was, you know, all of this fantasy stuff, because I didn't know what was going on. I just felt like shit, that's all. So everything is not up to me. If that happens, that happens. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. But right now, in this moment, I have to be here with the cold that I have, with the bronchitis that I have, with everything else. And moment to moment, watch the arising of this or that. Watch the arising of change. Those of you who have a variety of this particular virus, because I think it is the one that's been around since December and that's traveled the world, and that many of us have some iteration of. One of you said, it's sort of like it just is seeking out mucus to tamper with the mucus, to get the mucus to get stronger. And it is. It's like a heat-seeking missile, this virus. It really wants to survive, just like the rest of us. So having patience means that we do not keep our own agenda. We do not get to control the way things are going to be. And we hear this a lot. We hear this a lot. But watching this particular virus, I think all of you know how it keeps changing. It's one of the best Dharma teachers I've ever had, and I really, really hate it. I just would like to find another Dharma teacher as quickly as possible. But the lesson is, for a few moments, the chest hurts. Then for a few moments, the throat hurts. Then it goes into the sinuses. Then there's sniffles. Then there's a surprising sneeze. Then it goes back into the chest. Then it's all gone. And then it comes back. How amazing. It's just, if we say it's a cold or it's a virus, we are encapsulating it as if it was a thing that was not alive. And it's very much alive. It's a whole community of viruses that are, have found a good home in some of us. And one time, a long time ago, when I had mononucleosis, I was taking a hypnosis course, and the hypnotist instructed us to make up an image for any pain in the body we had or any sickness. And I had mono, so I went. He led us through a deep hypnotic trance, and suddenly I noticed that my body was just full of these little blue creatures, like Smurfs, and they were building little apartments out of mucus everywhere in my body, and they'd settled in, and when I told him this, he said, "Oh, great! Let's use this as an example. I want you to go back into your trance and ask them to move out." And they didn't want to move out. It was the nicest place they'd ever lived, and they just loved it. But ultimately, over the next, months, I noticed every once in a while that one or more of them would pack their little bags and their little suitcases and just walk away, waving goodbye. And finally, they were all gone. Lucky for me. It doesn't happen for everybody. So what a mystery, right? Why, we are interacting, we are interbeing with a virus. How amazing. If we do the being one-sided, then the viruses are bad and we're good and they need to leave. Just a simple fact. But if we open ourselves to the community of all beings, well, it's a very different matter. It doesn't mean that we don't hate them. I think hating them is a big part of it. But maybe that's a little bit extra. Maybe it's just, coming and going, letting things come and go. Going and coming, we are never astray, as Hakuin says. This is the truth that, at least based on my observation, that I've found, nothing stays the same. Even though I think it's never going to change, it's going to be this way forever, it changes. And of course, sorry to say, and many of you know this, sometimes it gets worse. And then we make peace with that, and on we go. So having patience is another way of talking about not being one-sided, letting things unfold. And Trungpa also calls this crazy wisdom. Crazy wisdom, one way of talking about it is that everything that arises needs to be seen through a very spacious view, a non-consensual view, not through the ordinary way we think about things. My first teacher used to talk about when we first awaken to the Dharma, we live in the upside-down kingdom. The kingdom where everything is backwards, upside down, not what we expect it to be. It's crazy. But Trungpa combines the word crazy with wisdom because there is that clear seeing, that clear knowing that things are not as I thought they were. Things are much bigger than this, very different, not the same. We do not know everything about the world. This is why we call what we do practice. We call it practice because there is no performance at the end. There is no final exam. There is practicing until the very end, always with the mind of a beginner, always with the mind of not knowing. So not doing outrageous things based on some delusion that we know everything, and not being one-sided, having patience, living in the upside-down kingdom, in crazy wisdom, living with the quality of just this. Those of us who do breath practice, those of us who do Shikan Taza, those of us who do koans, all of these practices are pointing in the same direction. Breath practice, preparation for the last breath. Shikan Taza, preparation for being present with everything. Koan practice, preparation for having some kind of an understanding of crazy wisdom, of the upside-down kingdom, and being able to bring that understanding back to our ordinary lives. No final exam. No curriculum even in this weird, crazy life that we're living. Just this. Thank you. So, please make yourselves comfortable, and we'll go around and introduce ourselves. I'm Marissa.
I'm Bill.
I'm Jenny.
Henry.
Susan.
Carol.
Tom. Ray.
Alan.
I'm Joanne.
Debbie.
Esther.
David.
Oh, and this talk is being recorded. He just pointed to the recorder, which means that if there's anything that anybody doesn't want recorded, just say the word and we'll just turn it off while you're talking. So, you know what to do? Questions, observations, reflections? Yes, Bill?
In your talk this morning, I was struck early on when you talked about the separation and divorce, that sometimes it's better for both parties for that to happen. And that was so reassuring for me, because personally I'm going through this situation at the moment.
Right.
And so you have lots of time to examine this during sessions. And I'm pretty convinced that what I did was right for both of us, and that I felt I was harming both of us the last couple of years in the relationship. So I was wondering, also another point, a friend from way back when I was his best man at his wedding. He said, what about your wedding vow? Death do us part. So that was like an arrow in the heart, too, hearing that. So anyways, I was wondering if you have any further comments or about the process of separation. Now, sometimes it can be a better thing than hanging in there.
Yeah, we make these vows, and we set our intention, and it does seem so important that in the discipline of relationship that we vow to hang in there, you know, through all of the reflections that come at us from this other person, and so that's one thing. And everything is impermanent, and things that we thought we could count on, it turns out we can't. And that every relationship will end in separation, one way or the other, right? There is no relationship that continues. This is a great tragedy. In some ways, whenever a relationship or something ends, it is a real death that needs to be mourned. Sometimes it's over. And we have to continually be reaffirming our vows, or if we can't reaffirm our vows, to clarify what it is we can affirm. And, you know, sometimes people look at me and Melissa and say, oh my God, you guys, you've really, you know, done it. How wonderful. And, sometimes I think, well, we're both just too afraid to run away, in those moments. But more than that, there is some kind of karma unfolding of, our paths come together, and no two paths stay together, and sometimes, what is it? The one view, to trust. We have to trust ourselves.
Trust the most important.
Yeah, the trust the most important view, and we have to do these things. And I think it's in some way beyond right and wrong. We want to say, well, I was right or I was wrong, or it's wildly painful. And it's terrible, and it is what was clear to me that I needed to do or need to do. So, no easy way to say, well, just stay no matter what. Well, actually, people don't just stay, and you can live in a relationship and have checked out long ago. Say, well, I would never get a divorce. I would never be. I don't ever talk to my partner. I hate her every morning when I see her. But I would not be like those other people. So there is something about, it's not about how it looks, something beyond that.
Yeah, and I think I'd add too, just as a refresher for our relationship, we went through two huge crises in our marriage, and we got ritual divorces. Both times. So I always like to say I'm on my third marriage with David. I was married to him two times before. but it felt very important symbolically. And I think the reason for that, too, was that human beings start out together, and there are certain assumptions, and then things change. It's related back to the talk again, right? That things don't stay the same, and there's a certain point where we've got to redo this. This is all, we can't keep going based on what happened before. And the crises were the wake-up calls, like, whoa, we're in trouble. We better do something. We actually put our wedding rings in a Tupperware container and put it in the freezer.
Wow.
And it was a great moment when we took it out. And they were cold. But that was months later. So that this, I think nothing lasts. You know, even these long-term marriages, all the people I know who've been married for 30, 40, 50 years have had a lot of shifts and changes. You know, it's not just steady state going forward. And so sometimes that means if you're not with a partner who can agree to honor the change that's happened, then I think things start to move.
I'm putting my toe into the water of the dating game.
Oof.
And, boy, things are a lot different than they were 35 years ago. So I'm very, very slow at going this new.
Ooh. Yeah, you have a new life. And we all do every moment.
Mm. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
So, as one of a number of us helping to host our latest Vows community.
You know, oh, if we should do a practice
Boundless,
agreement.
Boundless Way Temple viral community. And I was happy to see so many of them turn out for our morning practice. You know, I was struck by when you said, well, you know, we hate them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was remembering something in Shinya Suzuki's second collection of lectures, you know, Not Always So.
Mm.
And he's talking to his Sangha about dying with stomach cancer.
Mm.
And he says, I need to make friends with my cancer. Mm-hmm. And so I wondered about if you would talk a little bit about that transit from the initial, of course you hate your cancer when mm-hmm. you first have it. Of course you hate your viruses mm-hmm. when they first take up residence. And but then what about that process mm-hmm. of coming to be friends with them?
Well, and I think the Lojong teachings are real pointers here, right, for that, because there's absolute bodhicitta and relative bodhicitta. So in the world of relative bodhicitta, relative compassion, hatred arises. These opposites arise. And in the world of the absolute, no. So love and hate. You know, actually, the Dogen talks about that right at the beginning of Genjo Koan, because it's like sometimes from this view, it's this or that, and sometimes from that view, it's all of this, and sometimes from the, and then at the end he says, you know, flowers fall though we love them, and weeds grow though we dislike them. This kind of coming, so maybe it's not hatred anymore, but it's inconvenient to be sick. And sometimes it's really, really challenging. So if we try to make friends with something that we hate, we're missing the root in the absolute, which is recognizing that we and the thing we hate are one. So that's first, I think, before befriending. But we talk a lot about befriending in practice also. You know, the guest house by Rumi, that poem where the inconvenient guests come and, you know, we hate them. But we make room for them. And the Milarepa story about the demons, and you serve tea to them. You know, there's some way of meeting. But it's a lesson that I've really learned over the years that allowing myself to dislike things without thinking I'm failing as a Buddhist, things and people, you know, to have aversion. Because aversion and attraction arise endlessly. So sometimes I hate it. I have to say, last night, I loved having this virus because it got me out of the temple. God, I can't laugh. It's so horrible. And I met all these wonderful people, and I got to give Ray an opportunity to have a pizza. And I also got to go to sleep early. Like, and I think I don't do self-care real well. So it was like, I was really happy that I called the doctor right away as soon as I got symptoms, which I also don't do. I kind of keep going on, or I have in the past, the person who used to be me. So there, I was grateful to it last night, but it wasn't because I decided to be grateful. It was because it naturally rose. Like as I was lying in bed, well, you guys were all doing Dokusan down here. It was so great. I felt so safe and warm and cared for by the Sangha and by the Dharma, and by the awakened nature itself. So it naturally arose. So that's the thing I'd say, that not to force the friendliness, but of course you're absolutely right. We don't continue to hate these things. And when we do, that's a problem as well, because that becomes fixated. Yeah? That's my little thing on that. Do you want to say that?
Yeah, just that I think this is such an important point, because there's this these teachings about friendliness, and everything that arises as our teacher can so quickly go into, well, you should like what's happening, right? And it gets into a should. So just to reemphasize what Melissa said, so we start where we are, as Pema Chodron says in the wonderful title of her book, and just the being one-sided, the, you know, being a meditator, and those of us that have been doing it for a long time, we know how we should feel. Right? And it's so easy to, then it makes it harder to know how I really feel, because, you know, after 50 years of meditation, this should not be a problem. Right? And then that's a problem. So how to give ourselves full freedom and really pay attention, that little irritation is a kind of aliveness, and the one who doesn't like this, who feels sorry for himself or this or that, can be very subtle. And for some of us that are so used to overriding, it's just a cold, it's not a problem, but just, you know, we need to practice complaining more. You know, because I was taught, you know, doesn't matter. You know, I don't want to hear that. And many of us have that internal thing. You know, meditator, not a problem. I'm fine. I'm just dying. But don't make a big deal. And I know I am a great minimizer. Like, whatever goes on, it's like, it's okay. You know? And so that's lovely, and there's some good things about that. But it can also make it harder for me to appreciate the places where it's not okay. You know, and then I can present this front to the world. Hey, I'm okay. And then I wonder why I feel lonely. It is, you're so okay. So to really honor those little fluctuations and go, wow, yeah, I'm okay. And I don't like this, or I feel weak, or I feel scared, or, you know, and it doesn't have to be, well, I hate this. For me, it's much milder. Oh, I really don't like this. And I have to pay attention to know that, because it's okay. I've been drilled in that, and I've drilled myself, it's okay. How are you, David? I'm okay. true, and wonderful spirit, I would say, if I was meeting myself. And what else is going on? And so to name that, these teachings, how do we make friends with everything? And we make friends partly by being honest about where we are, and when we don't like something, and when we're angry, we get to be the Buddha of resentment, and dance in that fire and be cooked in all the fires that we encounter.
And just to say too, the whole thing that snuck into the self-help movement a few decades back, that you should be grateful for your cancer, did a lot of disservice to people with cancer, who to this day, it's still in the culture that if you get sick, it's your fault, and because you didn't have the right attitude.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that killed it. When I worked in hospice, we saw refugees from people who you know, they were dying, but they felt like failures.
Yeah.
I mean, because they'd been told. There was a surgeon in New Haven who wrote a bunch of books about it, Bernie Siegel, that they had failed. Yeah, I mean, oh my God. He later recanted, but he did a lot of damage before that. And And this minimizing, I want to just clarify too that David got really, really sick at one of these coming and going sesshins a few years ago.
First one.
Was the very first one. And you were not minimizing. You were lying in bed.
No, I was maximizing.
Yeah, he was.
I do have that capacity.
Even minimizers have the capacity to maximize.
Right. I like to think of myself as a minimizer.
Right.
So then I identify with that. And actually, not true. Yeah, thank you for...
Mm-hmm. So maybe we're heading for another divorce. Thank you. Yeah.
So I maximized last night. Which
oh, good.
Ready.
Great.
Yeah.
For minimizers, that's very helpful.
For minimizers, yes. And as I woke up in the night and also this morning, I had like these waves of fever coming and going. And then this morning when I woke up and my head felt like this big congested ball, like a tennis ball that's just full of something. Then for some reason, and I think it's because I've been sitting with or exploring the joy that we talked about. Is where is joy, or where is a sense of freedom? Because for me, joy is a lightness and a spaciousness. And surprisingly, this came in as I was lying in bed. It's like, I wonder what parts of my body are not feeling horrible. And so I walked around and I found out there are quite a few places. I was like, okay, the lungs are fine so far. You know, and there was some some relief, but that's not quite the word I'm looking for, but a very direct experience and not wanting it. Like, I didn't set out on and now I want to be friends with a part of my body that's not okay. But rather an opening that happened of its own, opening of my awareness. And when I allowed that, because I saw where the pain was, my attention got almost like the end of a needle right in there. And so if I stayed there, I was really miserable. But there was something that was possible around opening up the awareness around it and then noticing all the parts that were okay. And so that somehow gave me encouragement. I'm like, okay, well, not completely, not everything is terrible. Not everything is hurting. And there's a lot of life, and my body's really doing a lot of work right now. I even have a fever. to combat what was going on. And I really appreciate how it arose. I wasn't trying to impose a mental change how I feel project. But it just sort of...
Yeah, and I think this is the teaching, that as we look into what's here, that there, then we it loosens up a little bit, or we see that the story we're telling... one of the things when I get sick, I often go around the whole day, I go, I'm sick. You know, but when that narrative loosens up, I wonder what parts might be feeling different, and we look into it, and then there is this, ultimately we're saying that this friendliness is the nature of life. So we're not trying to impose the friendliness on top to whitewash everything else, but we're saying, if we look and we see the impermanence and see it's all coming and going, then there is this natural arising. We're not faking it or making it up, but still the same, and yet a bigger container, and that makes quite a difference. And if we talk about the quality of our life, then that shift when external is almost exactly the same, maybe exactly the same, and then it shifts a fraction of a degree, and like, oh, there is a buoyancy here in the middle of exhaustion. It's Joanne lying in bed laughing with Henry David Thoreau, utterly exhausted. Thank you.
So maybe at that point we will stop.